Laughing Eyes Kennel presents The Gypsy Musher with Iditarod and Yukon Quest veteran Hugh Neff. The Gypsy Musher will share stories from the trail, fortune-telling, and memories of mushing years past. Follow The Gypsy Musher on Twitter and visit our website at gypsymusher.com.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and on the line we have our co-host calling in from Tok, Alaska. Hugh, how are you?
Probably feeling a little bit better than you are today, Robert, but dentists have a habit of doing that to people's teeth every once in a while.
You know, I was foolish enough to get my wisdom tooth taken out when I was 40 years old. I guess most people take them out when they're teenagers, so I'm a little bit behind the eight ball a little bit.
Yeah, but, you know, it's nice to be a dog musher who can afford to have their teeth worked on.
I guess that's true. Most of us, we can barely afford a fast food burger, much less the dentist. So I agree with you 100% there. So today we're going to talk about a couple of things on the Gypsy Musher. We're going to talk about getting on the sled for the first time. Hugh has a friend up from Washington that is learning the ropes from one of the best Iditarod and Yukon Quest veterans there is, as well as how to handle cold weather and maybe the proper gear that you need and dealing with some of those extreme temperatures that you deal with on the trail, as well as our weekly sled dog profile. We're going to talk about Hugh's dog, Jewel. She is a leader for Hugh's team, and I look forward to hearing about that. So, Hugh, let's talk a little bit about your experience with your friend up there and being on the sled for the first time.
Yeah, I have to chuckle every time somebody calls me a veteran musher because, for me personally, I always just feel like the eternal, you know, Chichaco rookie musher, and I think that is what keeps me vibrant in my career, is I'm always seeking to learn, and I'm never really settled with who I am and what I'm about. But Bruce actually has been on a sled before. Bruce Hagstrom's my buddy from my hometown of Evanston. Didn't know him that much growing up, but we've been good buddies for the last decade now. He actually rode my second sled in the Iditarod a few years ago for the ceremonial, so he got up a few days ago and flew into Fairbanks, and he's here for a few weeks helping me out. Anyhow, we did just get off the sled about an hour ago. We did a 25-mile run this morning, double sledded with a couple dogs, and, you know, takes a while to get, you know, your training wheels back on, as they say, and get everything feeling flexible in the body. So he had a few minor, you know, small wipeouts, but nothing major, and that's the reason why I like to have the buddy system and double sled this early in the year, just because, you know, stuff like this will happen when there's low snow and pumped up dogs and all that. But, you know, like we talked about last week, it's a lot like skiing, and you have to learn that you have to be very flexible with your body and can't be too rigid and stiff. You have to really, you know, learn how to bend those knees and sort of go with the flow on the trail. And he had a good time, though, and it's beautiful here. I mean, a couple days ago it was 20 below in the morning, and today it was 20 above, so it was a nice, fun morning to enjoy on the trail with the dogs.
So when you talk about double sleds, for people that don't know what that is, tell us about that.
Just connect a gang line, a couple of extra, you know, maybe 15 feet between the sleds of a cable or a rope, whatever you're wanting to use as a musher, and that will hook the front sled to the back sled, and so you'll actually have a sled behind you that will be there almost like an anchor, and it's a nice way for beginning mushers to learn the ropes without being too nervous, even though on those turns that second sled actually gets whipped around a lot, so it's actually a bit more dangerous than your first the sled that's closer to the team. But, you know, that's how I learned how to mush when I came up here in 95 and was working for Bill Mitchell and Curtis Earhart over there in Chena Marina outside of Fairbanks, or in Fairbanks, but on the edge of it. And Curtis would have this fancy, you know, sprint sled, and I'd have this big old toboggan sled that I had bought off Charlie Boulding. And on those turns, I was wiping out left and right, and Curtis, you know, would have this little chuckle on him. And he, I think, possibly knew that he was training me up. And that's, you know, part of the deal about being new into this sport or this lifestyle, especially with, you know, some quality athletic dogs that are going to be flying out there. When we leave that chute or, You know, when you leave the yard on a training run, you're on the drag mat hard trying to slow that team down, but you're still doing at least 20 miles an hour. And, you know, those sprint teams are doing up to 30 miles an hour. And as a person, say, in Chicago or New York, you're thinking 30 miles an hour isn't that fast in a vehicle. You have to imagine we're on a little 30-pound sled. So for us, it feels like you're flying out there. And that's why corners can be a bit dangerous early on in the training run. But thankfully, here in Tok, a lot of the trails are really straight and mellow, and I like them that way early in the season. If I want to get into some hairy trails, I'll go on a long overnight or, you know, weekend trip somewhere. I don't want my training trails to be too dangerous, because sooner or later the odds are going to be stacked against you if you have some pretty rough trails that you're training on.
So when you have a relatively new musher on the sled with you, riding in the front sled there, how long is it typically before you can kind of let the you know, the purse strings go and let him go out on his own if he's pretty new to it?
I try not to let them go out on their own. It is nice nowadays, you know, if you have a cell phone and you have good reception, you could stay in contact with them. I mean, I've talked to my buddy Ray Reddington often, and he's out running his dog somewhere there in Kinnick. But I would maybe start somebody off with a smaller team, say 6 to 8 dogs somewhere in there, depending on how big a person they are. And then, you know, take 2 separate teams out. But what I like to do sometimes is I'll go on a, you know, a 80-mile run or, you know, somewhere thereabouts, and I'll have a huge team, maybe double sled with up to 20 dogs. And then at the halfway point of that run, I'll actually divide that 20-dog or 18-dog team up into 2 smaller teams. Then on the way home, we'll go at a slower pace. It all depends on your time constraints, the type of trail you're on. The trails I'm on are nice and safe around here, so they're not too twisty or turny, and that makes it a little bit easier as far as putting a beginning musher out there. But definitely caution is the main thing to worry about this time of year, because the trails are a little bit dangerous. The snow really hasn't been that amazing just yet. We did get another 3 inches here in the last couple of days. But for me personally, like, I ran the four-wheeler yesterday with a team with Bruce, just to show them the trail, first of all, which is a good idea. Let these people see the trail they're going to be on. But being on a four-wheeler just sort of drives me crazy, to tell you the truth. It's just not the same feel for me, and I can see it with the dogs, too. They definitely enjoy being on the sled more. So if you have the time, just run small teams with sleds. But if you don't, obviously, you have to use that four-wheeler, which might be safer. But for me, I learned a lot more about the dogs being on a sled, I think.
One more rookie question for the new guys out there on the trails. I'm sure you hear a lot of times, oh, I can do that. That looks pretty easy. Can you give one piece of advice for somebody that may have never been on a sled before in his life, and all of a sudden he gets the chance to ride with one of us guys, and you know, and we let him go, and there he's going. What one piece of advice can you give a brand new guy, Hugh?
Oh, it's like I told the class I was doing the school tour in May, and I was in Central Ohio at Mrs. Young's school, and I just told these kids, you know, they're a little bit older, eighth graders, and, you know, they're just sort of sitting there staring at me going, who's this guy? And I told all these kids, the dumbest person in the world is the person who thinks they know it all. And the smartest thing you can do in the North, I mean, you saw that movie Into the Wild. That kid just went out there on his own and thought he could handle everything on his own, and that's not how you make it up here in the North or really anywhere in the world. You need to surround yourself with a quality group of people that are going to support what you're about, and they're going to be looking out for you. I remember going from village to village, and if I didn't call back to Minto when I got to Tanana to let, you know, Josephine Riley or one of the Rileys know that I made it safely to Tanana, they would be mad at me. So I would say the main thing you need to do is, you know, let other people know what you're about. Don't just be going out in the woods on your own with a team and, you know, expecting everything to be perfect, because these early season training runs, you have to expect problems to happen. These dogs are, it's you know, new to them, a lot of the younger dogs, and you just can't be in a hurry, really. You got to take your time. You have to really go with the flow. And, you know, the key to my career, and, you know, I've not had the the most enjoyable career, that's for sure. I've had a lot of ups and downs, but and I see it in all walks of life, not just dog mushing, is stress and anxiety. And if you can learn to even sometimes force yourself to smile and be happy, it's going to get you through those tough times. And that's what I try to do if I, you know, wipe out and I've got a big, you know, mat of snow in my face. And often you're embarrassed, you know, you can't believe that happened. But, you know, it's part of life is you have to get up and persevere. And typically when you do wipe out, it's just like that movie Snow Dogs. You know what those dogs are doing? They're usually barking away and laughing at you because they know that they got one on their master. And that's just the way dogs are. I think humans don't really realize how much personality, how much character, and how much dogs have upstairs. You know, they're quite a gifted creature.
I totally agree, and that's one of the one reasons why I've done this, working with dogs, whether it be mushing or just regular old training for the last 20 years. It's just that insight that we can gain from those creatures is what makes life so enjoyable, at least to me. So we're talking to Hugh Neff. He is Iditarod and Yukon Quest veteran. He is also the Gypsy Musher, and this is the Gypsy Musher on Blog Talk Radio. You can find out more about us on gypsymusher.com and follow us on Facebook as well. Hugh, let's talk about cold weather gear, surviving kind of in the cold weather. What do you have in terms of insight for some guys that are down there in the States? I remember I said this when I came up here, oh, I've got enough gear, no problem. And the first thing I learned was everything that I had brought up here did not work well in Alaska. So what can you tell us first about gear living up here in the North?
Well,
personal,
I mean,
gear.
I go back to, I can't remember the exact date, I thought it was the 1800s, I believe, but the Franklin expedition up on the Northwest Passage there where, or look at Scott going down to the South Pole, you know, thinking that dogs were beneath his dignity to use. You first of all, you got to go and talk to the people who have lived here for thousands of years, the natives, and learn from them. Whenever I go to a native village, I find out who the elder ladies are and go, hey, you got any mitts for sale? If I need mitts or a hat or what have you? Because they're the ones that are going to make the stuff that's, you know, quality and it's going to last a long time. But I totally agree. Whenever I have anybody coming up to visit or help out, what have you, I always say, don't bring a lot of stuff with you, first of all, because you know how the airlines are charging stuff nowadays. But the gear down there that they're going to sell in the stores just isn't going to cut it up here typically. And it makes a lot more sense to go to Prospectors, you know, in Fairbanks, or there's a bunch of different places around the Anchorage and Wasilla area to get stuff. And the thick, super thick stuff, usually for me personally, isn't what I'm looking for. I wear a lot of layers, actually, that are breathable. Because for me, like I think I mentioned last week, I'm like a dancer back on that sled. I don't want to be just sitting there like a big piece of meat, you know, freezing to death back there. I want to be, you know, occasionally kicking. I don't run up every hill, but every once in a while I love to, especially in races, I love to just run, pretend I'm Ramey Smith for a mile or two. You know, it's all about you being one with the dog team. So the gear that I try to, you know, accessorize myself with is typically stuff that I'm seeing other mushers wear in races. And I can maybe possibly get away with a little bit more because I think my body's acclimated to the weather up here. I've been up here long enough. You're going to need probably more gear if you're coming from the south, obviously, because your body's not used to it. But myself, I've been doing this for over a decade now, and I know how to deal with my fingers as they start getting cold or what have you. Like this morning, I'll tell you a major mess up that a lot of people do is they get in their dog yard, they start hooking up their team, they're wearing all their clothing. By the time they're ready to take off out of the yard, they're sweating to death. Put your heavy stuff on towards the end when you almost got the team all hooked up. You don't have to be running around the yard with all your gear on. And also, just because it might be 20 above in your yard, once you get on that trail and your team's moving at 10 miles an hour, that wind chill factor is going to start affecting your feet and your face and your fingers. So always bring a little bit more gear, and you can always just pack it in your sled bag. You don't necessarily have to use it. Like this morning, I was like thinking, oh, it's 40 degrees warmer than a couple days ago, so So I just wore gloves, and my hands started getting a little nippy there at the end because I didn't bother to bring my mitts with me. So extra gear is fine. Just don't be wearing it all the time. Wear it as you need it. Nearly every race I do, when I'm going up a mountain, I'm actually taking layers off and stuffing them into the sled bag because it's getting warmer and warmer. And then when I get to the top of that mountain, I'm going to throw all that gear back on real quick because that temperature is going to plummet probably 20 or 30 degrees by the time you get back down to the base of that mountain. So a lot of it, you know, is just getting out on the trail before the races and testing out your gear as well. Don't buy some fancy gear and then put it on the day before the race. That is definitely not a good idea, especially when it comes to stuff like boots. Stuff like that, you want to try all the different styles out and see what you like the best. I prefer the Jeff King Cabela stuff. That's what I like, but everybody has, you know, what they're looking for. I'm a bad – people have seen pictures of my feet in the paper. I get some bad trench foot if I don't take care of my feet properly. I froze my left foot a long time ago, about 8 years ago, and it's one of those deals where I have to deal with that all the time now. And so I'm very cognizant of taking care of my feet. And that being said, your boots are important, so are your socks, too. A lot of people wear a lot of thick socks, but if your feet aren't breathing right, you're just going to sweat and, you know, get cold down there. So I actually wear a real thin pair of socks, and then I'll put some heavier type of wool socks above it.
So how do you know when you've gone over the edge in terms of getting too cold? Is there something that your body says that, you know, it's just pointing off red flags, hey, you're getting too cold here? What are some of the signs and symptoms that you may see or deal with out on the trail?
Oh, well, I mean, I've run dogs 55, 60 below during the quest some years, and if you have the right gear and proper, you know, fur on your rough and everything, that's doable. I'm actually as worried about the dogs being protected with, you know, good, you know, I've got a Wolfsten dog jackets that I use, and they've got to have all their private parts protected. The cold I don't worry about, to be honest with you. It's the wind, and everybody saw what happened to my face a couple of years ago when my rough didn't stay on my parka. So I definitely have a nice neck protector, you know, to put over your nose and stuff. But that can be dicey as well because sometimes you start breathing and that's going to get all frozen up and full of, you know, ice. So you have to be careful about pulling that up and down depending on how much exercise or how heavily you're sweating. And then, you know, in a blizzard, I did 440 up in Kotzebue a few years back. And I felt sorry for Sebastian and Michelle Phillips because that was their first time in Kotzebue. And for the first 50 miles, it was such a blizzard. You couldn't even really look at your dog team. You were looking at the ground because it was that bad, the windstorm. And so you better be prepared and have good goggles for situations like that on the coast, that's for sure. But when do you know? I've been hypothermic before, and it's, you know, you start getting the shakes and all that, and a lot of that has to do with just staying properly hydrated. When we're out on the trail sometimes, you know, you're force feeding yourself or you're making yourself drink those fluids because, you know, if you don't, problems are going to happen later on down the trail, i.e. either hypothermia or hallucinating.
Well, and you know, when you're 50 miles from the next checkpoint or out there on a long training run, you know, it's not something where you can just jump in the house and get warm real quick. You're sometimes hours away from being able to warm up. Have you ever dealt with that in a way where you thought that, you know, it just wasn't going to go good?
Oh, no. You know, I don't have a great memory, so I'm sure it has happened in the past, especially when I was starting off. You know, I noticed that I wore a lot less clothing than, say, Martin Boozer or John Baker or Jeff King. They would have the thick clothing, and I couldn't. I was always like, why do those guys wear so much clothing? And then I realized it's because they have the real good teams that are moving fast, and a guy like Sonny Linder probably doesn't even know what a ski pole is, you know, because those guys, every year I say, you know, the top athletic team doesn't necessarily win a race like the Iditarod or the Quest, because a lot of those guys don't really care about winning. They're just out there to enjoy a race that they've done for 25, 30 years and enjoy the scenery. But yeah, situations like that, you're usually going to stop on the trail more for your dog's needs as much as yours. So if your dogs are starting to flounder a little bit and it's looking like they need a breather, that's when I tend to pull over more, would be more for what the dogs need than necessarily my personal survival. I've been through a lot over the years. I don't think too many other people in this world have the threshold for pain that I've had, just dealing with different body ailments. And you learn from a guy like, you know, George Atla or William Clayton or guys like that. I mean, if they can do what they're doing with, you know, some body issues, then I'm not about to complain. And you saw what Rick Swenson did last year with his, you know, busted collarbone on the steps, and then he finished the race. I mean, in Alaska, it's all about, you know, persevering, because we're all going to see situations out there on the trail, and it's about staying positive yet cautious. And obviously, you have to take care of yourself, though, because by taking care of yourself, you're going to take care of your dogs better.
Speaking of taking care of the dogs, talking about staying right in the extreme cold, you mentioned the dog coats with the parts that cover up the private parts of the dogs. I remember last year seeing those for the first time myself. It had a little flap of Wolverine fur or whatever it was for the male dogs. Can you describe that to our listeners a little bit, that maybe, you know, a fair weather musher, so to speak, that may live in Iowa or in Colorado or somewhere where it doesn't get cold enough where you would need something like that?
Well, first of all, nowadays, I don't know if there is much fair weather. I mean, every day is different here. I just couldn't believe 2 days ago it's 20 below and now it's 20 above. So the winds of time are always changing, it seems. But, yeah, we have little protectors. People use all types of fur to protect the boys, typically. With a lot of the dogs, you have to worry about their flanks as well, you know. That's where they might get a little bit of frostbite. I had problems with Annie having that last year that she got from the Kuskokwim race, which is typically a very windy race. I personally, for many reasons, neuter most of my boys. In fact, there's only right now in my yard, I only have one main boy that is my stud. His name's Sport. He's a dog that I got from John Baker, and he's pretty much the one dog that I really want to breed. I've got other boys that are intact, but I prefer to, you know, I don't want to get too specific on the radio here, but, you know, like Bob Barker said, it's what's best for the dog for long term. And in the cold, if the boy isn't totally intact, it's a little bit more comfortable for him, I believe. But yeah, jackets are a must. A lot of mushers, some veteran mushers would tell me they don't really prefer to run with the jackets on the dog. A houndier dog, less fur, they're going to need it. But I know mushers that won't put a jacket on a dog unless it's, you know, maybe 15, 20 below while they're running. In resting on the trail or in checkpoints, you definitely want to get that jacket on there. And that's going to help conserve body temperature and keep them warmer. And then you'll put some straw down underneath them to sleep on, but I definitely think it's good to put those on in checkpoints.
Let's talk a little bit about camping, Hugh. I remember last year I had posted something on Facebook or somewhere that said I was going to go out and camp with the dogs on a longer run, and somebody sent me a message back saying, "You lucky dog, you get to go camping with your dog." And I responded by saying, "Well, you're not doing a heck of a lot of camping. A lot of it's working in and around with your dogs, you know, preparing their food and things." Let's talk about that extreme weather and quote-unquote camping or that checkpoint style with your dogs. What can you share with us about that?
I can tell you that I love cabins. there's a reason they're built, and they tend to be a bit warmer, especially in windier sections of trail. Like there's a cabin in between Shaktulik and Koyuk that saved a bunch of us a few years back when that bad weather year. As far as camping goes, I did a talk here a few weeks back for the Quest over at the Carlson Center in Fairbanks, and talking to the rookie mushers doing the Quest, and just telling them that, man, in the old days, I would be sitting there, and we'd been resting maybe 4 or 5 hours, and I'd be sitting there sort of cold, the fire's going down, and I'd be looking at the dogs, and they were all sort of moving around and shaking, and they weren't really resting at all. But I had to wait another hour because, you know, you had to do six on, six off, or whatever your training run was. And I don't necessarily do that as much anymore. I rest and I camp according to what I see in the dogs. And if I see they're moving around, if I see they're perky, then we don't need to necessarily rest as much. Really, a lot of it has to do with where you are in the race and what type of train is coming up. Some of this terrain, if you're going down a mountain, you don't want to really camp out on top of that mountain. Not a good idea. So I would say, that being said, when I do camp, say, in Fairbanks, or if I'm on a trip to Tanana and I'm going to take a break somewhere along the trail, I'm going to do that high up, you know, a couple thousand feet up a hill or a mountain where it's going to be 20 degrees warmer. I don't want to be camping down on a riverbed, that's for sure. But camping, you know, you have your chores, you got to get the cooker going, you got to get that food into the dogs, usually start off with a kibble and then get the meat snack or what have you organized. I like to sort of try to teach the dogs how to rest quickly. It's tougher to do with younger dogs. That's why I try to pair them up with an older dog that's going to lay right down. And it's funny to watch because a lot of folks think when they see a dog lay down right away that it's tired. And sometimes they don't realize that's one really smart dog that's conserving their energy. So I don't really necessarily camp out that much, though, to be quite honest. I do long training runs. We're going to Eagle here in a few weeks. That's going to be a 4 or 5 day trip. I'm going with my buddy Jesse. But I don't really plan on taking a tent and like Frank Turner did his first quest with a buddy of his. That's really not the way we do things nowadays. And like I said earlier in another show, the more you dog mush, the more you realize how incredible these animals are and how much stronger they are pound for pound than humans are, you know. And that's why I love being with dogs, because they keep me young at heart, and they make me realize that I haven't even really come close to fulfilling my potential either. And I'm hoping to get better by the year if I can.
Well, I think you are getting better. Each year you seem to go up a little bit in the rankings, at least on the Iditarod, and you're having good races throughout.
That being said, that's not necessarily how I define if I'm doing better. I hope you understand that. Everybody, you know, it's huge on the internet, and everybody has their famous musher that they want to win and all that sort of stuff. But for every musher, it should really be about you knowing who you are, what you're about, and knowing your weaknesses and trying to work on them, and that's really what I'm trying to do in training. A lot of people look past the weaknesses and they don't think they have them, but we're all humans. We all have issues. And so if you can spot what you could work on to make yourself more proficient, that's just going to be better for you and the dogs in the long run.
If you care to share, Hugh, are you working on anything in particular that that you see as something that was lacking in years past?
Well, you saw the Iditarod video. For me, I don't know if it's a blessing or a curse or what have you, but I just have way too much energy, man. And I don't know if it's the coffee or just, you know, my passion for what I do, but every year I'm actually, in a way, enjoying getting a little bit older and hopefully mellowing out a little bit, because I just, I'm a pretty type AAA personality, and I'm trying to. There's a reason I don't have any or a lot of really close friends, because I think I annoy a lot of people, because I'm a chatterbox, and it's hard for me to sit still for very long. And, you know, if you want to enjoy life, you really have to learn to do that, and you have to learn to maybe meditate or whatever, because with all the gadgets nowadays, most people are pretty busy these days. But if you really want to enjoy life, you have to sort of mellow out sometimes and, you know, just enjoy a sunrise or a sunset. And that's what I'm trying to do, is enjoy the moment more, you know.
Is anything changing now that you're in Tok full time versus traveling back and forth like you have in years past?
Colder here. a little flatter train. I've got a smaller yard here. I only have 35 dogs. But they're 35 strong, you know, and some of them are younger. They're really not going to race as much this year. The older dogs seem to be enjoying the new trails. Get to see a lot more auroras up here, which I love. But, you know, life is, for me and for many of us that come to the north or wherever you are in the world, it's about exploring, you know, this beautiful planet that we're on. And for me to get out here every day, and the trails here might not be amazing as far as hills go or the views, but there's so many trails around here that on almost every run I could be breaking trail. And some mushers don't believe in breaking trail. You know, of course, your sprint mushers, they're all about seconds, so they're going to have a very fast, smooth trail that they don't even want anybody to use a brake on because they want it to be that perfect. But I love breaking trail. That's, for me, old-school mushing. It makes me feel like I'm back in the 1800s, you know, going to Dawson to, you know, search for gold or what have you. And I think it's, for me, the type of dog team that I'm looking to create, I want my dogs to be breaking through, you know, a few inches of snow all the time, because they are going to see tough trail in races. And as a long-distance musher, you really need to get your dogs on trail that isn't going to be like, you know, being on a golf course. You need to be, get out there and see all different types of terrain.
Is there a particular way that you can test your dogs or train your dogs to break trail? I know in past I've had dogs that, you know, will run into a perceived snowbank and they'll stop and they'll pretty much just give up right there. Is there something you can share about working your way through that with a new team?
Oh, I've had issues, man. I mean, we all have to deal with, you know, leaders either looking back at you sometimes. There are some special dogs out there. Like Gareth Wright had this dog named Jenny that's very famous back in the day that he actually did hand signals with. Of course, Gareth Wright, for people who don't know, one of the greatest mushers ever. He has his own breed of dogs called Aurora Huskies, and that's who his family is basically who trained me up when I got here. A couple of years ago in the Quest, we're going up Birch Creek. The snow machines hadn't put in any trail for us in the Quest, and thankfully it was just myself and Lance breaking trail. Everybody else had parked, was camping out, and my Lance had a much better team, obviously, and my leaders kept on slowing down a bit. How are you doing there, puppy? And anyways, Lance had this leader named Alana that just swerved right around my team through about 2 or 3 feet of snow and just plowed right on by. And if you can get a dog that's that G-Haw, you know, command leader like that, that's a great animal to have up and lead. That being said, I tend to not be in a hurry going through thick snow. I'm not going to push a team and, you know, fry them out by going too hard when the trail gets tough. That's when you want to take it easy. You know, there's spots in races where you can push it and spots where you have to take it easy. Breaking through trail, you don't want to be in too big of a hurry. I'll put some older boys up there that maybe are going to go 3 miles an hour slower, but breaking through that 6 inches or a foot or two of snow is going to be a lot easier on them than, you know, my tiny little sprint leaders like Jewel or Delilah or some of the girls that plowing through snow might be a little bit tougher on them.
Speaking of Jewel, that is our sled dog of the week that we want to talk about. Let's talk about little Jewel. I understand she's a leader for your team.
Well, you know, Jewel's got to be a pretty amazing leader when there's a picture of her in the newspaper from last year's race, and she's being hugged by another dog musher, Sebastian, there in Takotna. So I think Sebastian recognized that she's a pretty cool animal, and he was loving her up for me, which I thank him for. But she's tiny. I mean, she's only like 35 pounds. And a lot of these dogs, you know, going back to, I don't know, Ken Anderson used to have a dog named Allie, and I know a lot of Doug Swingley's dogs were super tiny. And people would be amazed how small some of these top Iditarod leaders are, or sprint leaders or what have you. But Jewel, I kid you not, has the most amazing little trot I've ever seen in my life. Most of these small little dogs, you would think they'd be fast loping dogs, but she's a trotting dog, and her feet are like pistons hitting the ground as we move. And it never slows down, and if I put her back in the team, say in swing or behind swing in the team somewhere, she'll be going so fast that she starts moving from side to side because she has that much energy. That being said, you don't necessarily want to put your sprint leader like Jewel up and lead the whole time because she's going to tire out those big boys in back. Like I did her out last year, I mean, from the start to the finish, she was in lead.
Wow.
And up there with Annie and a few other leaders. But she's just a consistent little girl, and she was in lead a lot in the quest as well with Delilah before the weather got really bad and I got Walter up there. Yeah, she's tiny. One of those dogs, you know, I don't really have to chain her up in the yard that much because except for feeding time when she's going to maybe try to steal some food from somebody else. But she'll always be following me around or messing with the rest of her litter mates of Annie's army there. Jewel, Jester, what have you, Joker. She's always running around playing with those guys. And it's one thing I've noticed about, you know, in our yard, I'm always letting dogs loose, you know, I don't know, four or five at a time. I want them all to be like a big canine community. I want them to know each other well enough where they ain't going to be having issues with each other out on the trail as far as, you know, not getting along. But when I let dogs loose, it's funny to watch because those girl dogs, they want to go play and, you know, mess with the boys and, you know, see how everybody's day is going. Where those boy dogs, they either want to follow me around, like Walter's, like, you know, right behind me wherever I go. It's pretty special. But the boy dogs are usually sniffing around trying to find out where all the extra food is that I either have, you know, I'm cooking something in the cook pot or maybe somebody hasn't finished their meal. So it's funny how the boys are just driven by food, I think, a little bit more than the girl dogs are.
How old is Jewel?
She's just going on four now, and like I said, I've got, you know, predominantly most of my team coming back next year, and I've got a bunch of youngsters here that I'll be doing some shorter races with in January. But smaller dogs, I believe, too, can probably race a lot longer into their later years, like June Marie, who was my original special girl. She did. She was racing when she was 11. She did the quest, and she did 10,000 milers between the quest and Iditarod. So those girls in front aren't necessarily going to be pulling as much and not doing as much of the workload as the folks towards the back that are closer to the sled. But they're the ones that are going to keep the boys in line too. These folks back home got to realize, though, in an Iditarod team or in a quest team, out of your 14 or 16 dogs in that team, if you're typically a veteran musher, you're going to have at least, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 leaders that you're going to rotate around. Because Jewel's a special dog that could handle being in lead for 1,000 miles, but most dogs, you know, need breaks here and there, and that's why we're rotating them around.
So how do you pair up a dog with Jewel? If she has such energy, and like you said, the little pistons are just pumping away, how do you find a dog that's going to be the right fit for her as a co-leader?
In training, I'll usually put a big boy up there next to her in front to keep the team lined out, like Walter. With her, I'm definitely a big believer, and you can look at the teams that are being, you know, the top 10 of races nowadays. Most of these teams, whether it's sprint or distance or what have you, they conform. They're families of dogs typically. And so I'll usually have Jewel run next to either George, who's her brother. Another brother is Jester. Another brother that's or sister, excuse me, is Juanita. So I like or Annie, her mom, of course. But I like to mix her up with not necessarily a dog that has the same gait as her, but she feels comfortable with. But that being said, as I go back in the team, I want dogs to have gaits that are a lot alike. So I don't know if that helps in the power ratio of pulling the sled, but it sure does make a pretty looking team, that's for sure. And that's what any musher should be doing. You want to be competitive, but it's just the beauty of creating that picture, you know, that just, I mean, Alaska's beautiful, but Alaska with a beautiful dog team in front of you, it's just, you know, it's majestic, and that's what we're all trying to create, whether it's Alaska or Minnesota or wherever.
I just have one follow-up question regarding Jewel. You mentioned a few minutes ago about Lance's team. He had a very powerful G Hall leader that would pretty much just go anywhere for him. And you mentioned Jewel was, you know, always, you know, line was out. She was tight. She was pumping away. Are you looking for a combination of that, or do you prefer one or the other when you're out there on the trails?
I don't necessarily mind dogs that are in the team sort of taking it easy every once in a while. You can't pull hard for 1,000 miles. Some of my best dogs are the ones that are some of them are the dogs that don't make the team are the ones that work too hard because they're going to stress their bodies out and they're not going to make it too far on the trail. You need a dog with a nice, steady rhythm, not necessarily a pacing dog that's not really going to pull that much. I want a dog that's going to be attacking the harness and, you know, really into what they're doing out there. But let me tell you a quick story about living in Tanana. There's a road called Sight Road there. I was working for Lester Earhart then, you know, one of the greatest mushers ever. And another great musher in that area was a guy named Freddie Jordan, who's a Quest veteran, and Freddie was just an amazing dude. So I'm going down Sight Road one time, and I look over to my right, and Sight Road's like a hill outside of Tanana, you know, along the banks of the Yukon River, and it goes up to an old military site they had up there. And we used to train dogs on this road, and it's a, you know, an unmaintained road in the winter, and you're going at a pretty fast pace because a lot of mushers use that road. And one time I'm looking over in the bushes, and there's a dog team that's flying back and forth through the bushes, and it's Freddie Jordan training up leaders to go in and out of bushes like, you know, say you're trying to get your driver's license and going through one of those obstacle course type deals.
Huh.
So there's some great stories of dogs that are like that. And what happens in races is these dogs get so into tune after they've been in the on the trail for a few days that as a musher, I used to have this happen with Marcellus, one of my old leaders when I was just starting out, that if I would say G coming into a checkpoint or whatever, because I knew a turn was coming up, say, 100 feet away, I had to be very careful because that dog would turn on a dime and take me wherever, you know, into some, you know, somebody's driveway instead of where I wanted to go into a checkpoint. So these dogs, the more experience you get, the more in tune they're going to be with what you're wanting from them. And that's why I'm not really big on doing huge training runs. I'm into running consistently, you know, 3-4 times a week this time of year, if not more. And it's just that day-in, day-out bond that you're creating with your dogs that's going to be fruitful in the long run. It's not whether your dog can come back, you know, at a certain pace into the yard after running 100 miles or what have you. That's not what I'm looking about. It's about the heart connection we have. And that's why I spend a lot more time than I used to in the dog yard, man. I'll spend a lot more time. I'm doing a few more meals a day, just out there walking around. We all know the story about Lance and how it helped him survive cancer, just being out there and hanging with the dogs and creating that atmosphere that is what makes champions. It doesn't happen, you know, when you hook up the team before the starting line. It happens in the summer and right now and, you know, for the whole dog's life. So if you're bored in the house and you got a bunch of dogs outside, go out and play with them. Because you know what? I don't think you can give dogs too much love. And those dogs, you know how they are. You get out in your yard and they always seem like they miss you, even if you've only been inside for a few minutes.
That's exactly right. Hugh, we have about a minute and a half. I want to make sure we mention about your brand-new hoodies and things that you have available. They are available. You can contact him through gypsymusher@hotmail.com. And before too long, we're going to have him for sale on his website at gypsymusher.com as well. Hugh, anything else you want to mention before we go? About a minute.
Yeah, just a big shout-out to my buddy Mike Pickle in Wisconsin. He's not only taken me to the Bears-Packers game on Christmas up in Lambeau, but he's the guy that has organized the hoodies and the shirts and the bandanas. You can check all that out. I also have a link to it on my profile page on Facebook. And they're styly hoodies. I mean, I've been getting a lot of people requesting them, and they're beautiful. They got a nice logo, our Laughing Eyes logo on the back, the state of Alaska with the eyes inside of it. And then they got a nice dog team, and picture of my boy Geronimo on them. So they're pretty cool. And, you know, they're just the start. Every just like dog mushing, I try to make my souvenirs pretty cool for the kids to enjoy as well. And
there you go.
I just want to thank you again, Robert. This is a great opportunity to spread the word about mushing, and I know a lot of school classes are listening to these shows throughout the U.S., and that's pretty awesome.
You know, it's getting great great listenership, so I'm glad to be here with you. Hugh, we'll see you next time, okay?
Yeah, peace, my friend.
Take care. This is Robert Forto on behalf of our co-host, the Gypsy Musher, Hugh Neff. We will see you guys next week. Until then, goodbye.